I still love playing my flute, and I love the feedback and the rapport I get from it. And I love the way some days it sounds great and other days it doesn't, you know, that it's very much an organic, living, changing thing. That obviously some days you're going to feel better, or maybe the weather's better or something. Other days you feel, oh, it's all uphill, do you know. And it's very, very exciting when you just feel everything comes together. It's very much part of you, an extension of what you are. And that's why I like the way it varies from day to day. Obviously, depending on how you feel or, you know, your connection with it, it's going to be really successful or not so successful. And it's kind of that unknown that I find, it, you know, just draws me back to it all the time.
I had thought that this might be a depressing story. A professional musician is losing her hearing and has had to leave her job because of it. But Elizabeth Petkoe is the kind of woman who, despite her hearing loss, has still got a passion for music. She's found new ways to express her artistic soul. She has a huge energy and a fierce curiosity about life. 3 years ago, Elizabeth finally made the decision to leave the RTE Concert Orchestra because of her hearing problem. Her otosclerosis had gradually worsened over the previous 15 years.
I wouldn't have left the orchestra had I not had this difficulty, because I love to play my flute. There's no substitute for playing as part of a big, loud, organised noise. There's no substitute for that. Even when I play with my friends, you know, there's three of us, I really enjoy that too, but it's not the same. But yeah, having to leave the orchestra was like as if another opportunity presented itself. So it wasn't all doom and gloom, although it wasn't without its trauma. You know, to have to finally admit that this was the right thing to do, but I am happy that it still feels like it was the right thing to do. So that gives me peace, you know, that I did take the right path, and I really love what I'm doing now.
I used to see Elizabeth and Mircea Petkoe on stage when I introduced concerts given by the orchestra. Mircea was in the first violins, Elizabeth was the principal flute. Both superb musicians they'd met in the orchestra. I knew that Elizabeth had had to leave because of a progressive deafness condition. So what was I thinking of then when I phoned the house to see if Elizabeth would talk to me about what she'd been up to since she left? Hello, hello. Could I speak to Elizabeth Petkoe, please?
Well, she's not here at the moment. Can I take a message?
Well, I was just wondering, has she got a mobile?
No, I'm afraid she doesn't have a mobile. She's 8 mobiles, in fact.
Oh, of course, yeah.
She doesn't. She'd rather prefer if you emailed her. You know, that's it's the best.
After that, whenever we needed to meet, I emailed her. Great.
How many dogs?
I've only 2. Well, she's new, so we haven't got managers
right.
Here yet.
Right.
Yes.
And right. Would you hear if the doorbell rang or if there was a knock at the door? Would the dogs help?
Yeah, my last one used to. We'll have to get her to do that. Because there's something wrong with the doorbell, so it's not that easy to hear, but I'd easily miss it.
Yeah.
On the phone, I often don't hear the phone. If I'm in there and the door is shut or something, I would.
Come here, you're right.
Well, this dog, Nina, she's new, and I took out my Sopranino recorder the other day and I tried a phrase. I don't think she'd ever heard music, full stop. And I thought she was going to turn her head around 360 degrees. She was just fantastically curious. But luckily, she didn't bark or howl or And her predecessor and his nibs there, anytime they heard me start on the Bach Partita when I was practicing for my CD, they'd both just give me a look and then just curl up because they knew they weren't going anywhere for at least an hour. And they were my best audience. They just curl up and listen and keep me company, you know, while I practiced all that. I think I have my flute since 75, and I've been very careful with it, you know, because I love it and I respect it, and it's in super condition. I think I've had it redone once, maybe new pads or something, but essentially it's the same instrument. Yeah, I feel this gives me another world, really. It's can go more places. And, you know, I really try and practice every day, and I just look forward to that time. I mean, there are always other distractions. I have to cook an evening meal. I have to get the clothes in out of the rain. I have to sweep the floor or whatever. But if I make time to play the flute, I always enjoy it. I always look forward to it. If I lose that pleasure, I'll just give up. But after I retired from the orchestra, I thought, I still love playing my flute. I don't want to throw in the towel just yet. My dad would really have been the one who was considered the one with music in our family. So we were all given the opportunity to learn, and since there was heaps of us, that meant having two pianos in the house at one stage, and my mother bringing us in and out twice, three times a week for lessons, picking us up from school and into Westland Row. I used to slip by where I knew my father was in the evenings without saying goodnight to him, because I knew he was going to ask me had I practiced, and usually the answer would have been no. So rather than face that embarrassment, I used to skip saying goodnight to him. But things did seem to come to me, you know, in a natural way on the flute. And so whenever I did scholarships or competitions or whatever, master classes, you know, I always seemed to get on great without having to kill myself. So, I mean, it did always feel right for me. There was Muriel Dagg lived in Sandymount at the time. My dad used to take me down to her on Saturday mornings, and she taught me recorder. I suppose I was about 7 or 8. And she was about 4 foot nothing, and I was so afraid of her. I was so afraid of her. She was a dragon. But she was a super teacher, so thorough and so exacting. I think she gave me, you know, a really good foundation for my flute technique. So I did descant and treble, you know, for 2-3 years with her. And then my parents brought me to the academy. I had been doing piano since I was 5 anyway, which gives you the harmony skills, the vertical and the horizontal idea about music, the treble, bass, clef, reading music, all that. So.
And then you went to
Doris Keogh. I could have gone to the corners of the world looking for somebody like her, but she was an example to me in every respect and looked after me like a mother, you know, as well as a mentor. And she was wonderful. And we used to go out to her house at weekends and play chamber music and sing and dance. And she would take us up Hoathhead to see the rhododendrons or out to Dollymount, you know, for our spiritual development as well, if you like. I mean, she did. She was the holistic approach teacher. She was wonderful, still is. I still go to her and play or chat or confer or whatever. I'm still in touch. She's a lifeline. I got real opportunities to play when I was only about 14. I think I've been deputising in the orchestras here since the time I was 14. And Doris used to say, if you haven't got your technique by the time you're 14, you know, it's too late. But I was lucky that perhaps there were openings or I don't know what. Frank Murphy, the manager of the concert orchestra, would ring up, you know, at 10 to 10 in the morning. He'd ring my mother and say, you know, any chance of a flute or something? And I'd have gone to school. But the principal in my school was very understanding and I was always let go and take these opportunities up. So I'd often turn up at 10:30 in my school uniform or something to play the piccolo part in some Irish jig or whatever. I mean, the repertoire they played at that time could have been anything. It still is very varied, but a lot of that Irish stuff they did was very, very tricky. My teacher used to say to me, do you know you have to wait until somebody dies to get a job? What's she on about? But she was right, because you know, I was lucky that I was available and around when there was a vacancy. But the vacancy must have come up around 79, 80, and I did an audition, got offered a trial or whatever, and got roasted alive in the first 6 months. I think they looked for every difficult flute piece in the library and put it in front of me. And I stayed there for more than 25 years. I loved every minute. I mean, in the early years I was learning so much I hardly had time to draw breath. Definitely one of the highlights for me was being invited to play the Ibera Concerto with the orchestra. I knew it to hear, but I'd never really looked at it in depth. So it was a big challenge for me to learn it in a time frame, a matter of months. But overall, I was very pleased, and I even got a lovely top D. It was just great. It was just great. I used to love the opera seasons. You'd often get visiting conductors who would bring with them, you know, the richness of their own countries. They very often wouldn't have any English, but that wouldn't matter because you kind of didn't need it. And they'd almost be extra expressive if they didn't speak, because they'd show more with their gestures. And obviously when we did Eurovision Song Contest, it was lovely to see visitors from all over the world coming to Ireland. And although musically you might get a bit tired of some of the songs, you know, they'd start to grab you at the end of the week and you'd kind of be getting into it. So I mean, there were lots of ups, to be honest, lots of ups. I really enjoyed the time we had with Laurent Wagner. I was never bored for a minute with the rehearsals we did with him, and he did some fantastic Beethoven symphonies in the Helix, which were attended by a handful of people. So again, you know, Beethoven's Sixth, and I was thinking, oh, that's my least favourite, I really don't want to play it, I'm tired of it, and all this kind of thing. When he did it, it just, he transformed it. He came to it with such a fresh, sensitive, musical angle. Thank you. really be a principal player and not take your work seriously. I mean, you have to deliver the goods. You have to not disappoint. You have to know everything that's in your folder and you'll be able to play it. And if it's tricky, take it home and fret and worry over it. You know, you do have to be on your toes. But that was the challenge that I liked. Of course, there's a lot of stress and tension and worry, you know, about how the concert will go, or will you count your bar numbers correctly, or, you know, will the conductor give you the cue? Is that high B-flat going to sound? You know, but you can't let those get in the way of the enjoyment that you're going to have from the opportunity to play such a great piece or something. So you've got to balance one against the other. But if something does go well and you know it has, that's really all you need. You don't need affirmation from other sources. Obviously, it's really nice if you get it, but fundamentally, I think you're your best judge in the end.
Will we go down and have a look at your workshop?
Oh, you want to see my bird? Yeah, okay. My workshop, that you mean on top of the washing machine?
The workshop is the place where Elizabeth spends hours working with clay.
It has a long tradition. It's an old-fashioned kick wheel, and I like that idea, the kick wheel, because you've no electricity, you're spinning the wheel with the movement of your leg, and you get into this nice rhythm, you know, because you're making the pot with your whole body. It's really, really nice. And I have some clay here that's kind of in fairly good condition, I'd say, for throwing.
And you're leaning on the clay.
So what I'm trying to do now is make sure that the clay is in the centre of the wheel, moulding my hands around it to get all the wobbles out. So that's the nice thing about throwing, is that you have to centre the clay on the wheel, and there's a kind of zen part to that, you know, where you don't even have to look at it. You're just feeling the stillness of the centering, you know. If I'm happy with the center opening, I would start working on the walls and bringing them up. I make a sort of Martello tower shape, mm-hmm. as my first teacher used to say. Isn't it wonderful? When I go out in the mornings, first thing is my dogs. Sometimes I go out the front, sometimes I go out the back. Depends on the tide. And I just love it in the mornings when it's fresh and clean. And maybe there's no footsteps on the sand or anything. You know, you're the first person to arrive. And I just love it. And the new dog that we have, Nina, when she came to us about 3 months ago, she didn't even know what water was. She was terribly funny. And now she just swims for the pleasure of swimming. I don't have to encourage her in or anything. She just goes in and swims around, or she might swim the length of the harbour wall or from one rock arm to the other. Happy as Larry, her two big ears, you know, like the Sydney Opera House sticking up out of the water. Years ago, I was walking along a beach in Sligo or somewhere. We were on tour with the orchestra. It was before I realised how deaf I was. Walking along the beach with two dogs, grand. I turned around and walked back, and suddenly I could hear the waves because I'm much deafer on one side than the other. And that was the first time that I really noticed such a marked difference. I thought it was quite funny. But I wouldn't really hear that sound if I didn't have my magic ears with me. So it's nice.
Was that the first time you realised that?
Well, I knew that it was happening very, very gradually, but that was a very sort of clear way of measuring it, if you like, because I got the immediate feedback or lack of it, you know, and the difference on both sides. When I get up in the mornings, Mir to be asleep, I get out of bed first, and I think I'm being really quiet, of course, because I can't hear anything. But if I happen to have my magic ears upstairs with me and I put them in, then I start hearing everything, like even the way your trousers might brush one leg against the other, or if you pick your watch up off the bedside table, what a racket it makes. he must be wide awake by the time I get downstairs. It is a very silent world if I'm not plugged in.
Well, I have these knacky little gadgets. Nobody can see them. So I was a bit disappointed. I thought I'd customise them with beads or something. But they sit behind my ear and I've only a tiny little attachment that goes into the ear. So they're very snug on a little sort of metal hook. But when I take them out and cover them up, they give me this funny feedback noise. That's actually how I know that they're working. Or if I forget to turn them off and I put them in the box like this, other people will hear that noise and tell me. But they just sit on the top of my ear, the main, I suppose, computer part maybe, and the little receiver is tiny, so they're very comfortable, better than anything I've had before. So I have one in each ear, but I think one is stronger than the other. Because I have a good ear and a bad ear. But it's very useful to hear that noise because at least you know they're working. I wasn't wearing any hearing aid at all because the one that I had first was enough to drive me to a mental home, so I forgot about that. But just before Christmas, I was given a tip. We did a concert for the hard of hearing people, which my family thought was hilarious, but we did and it went very well in Dunleary Yacht Club. But I got lots of tips there from the people who were at it or who were selling tickets or who were helping out that I should go to this audiologist in Dunleary. So I went to him and he sorted me out with the two gadgets that I'd never tried before. Maybe they're new design or something. They're relatively comfortable and very effective. They're self-adjusting, so that I'm not going to have a heart attack if a dog barks or there's a loud noise. So don't have to be turning them up and down like I used to before. And the one I had before, if I had it too loud, would just go off on its own and start to scream at me if I moved my jaw or anything like that. These don't. So from that point of view, they're magic. They're magic. They're really very, very good. And I, you know, from the first time I tried them, I thought, yes, I think I could go with this. In fact, I nearly had a heart attack when I stepped out of the shop into the mall in Dunleary, and I could hear the environment as it is for most people. I thought I was going to have to call an ambulance or something. I was so overwhelmed by the volume of sound out there. So that was quite an experience that impressed me deeply. That moment I'll never forget.
Elizabeth's voice is, as it always was, clear, musical, modulated. But I realise only now that when I've been talking to her, I've unconsciously been compensating, standing directly in front of her, speaking distinctly, making sure that what I say doesn't get lost in the whirl of sound around us. I can't imagine how distressing it would be for a musician to lose her hearing, but I'm struck by Elizabeth's philosophical attitude.
For me, it just happened so gradually that, again, it's like a pregnancy, but in slow motion, that on the first day you discover you're pregnant, you think, oh my God, you know, I can't cope. But by the time 9 months has elapsed, you're ready and waiting. So with me, you know, it was over 15 years. It wasn't overnight. It wasn't shocking, you know. So that was a good thing in a way. You had time to adjust and maybe get your head around it.
So I decide to conduct an experiment on the beach. I ask her to take her magic ears out.
Okay. Now, would you take your hearing aids out, please?
You want me to fly blind?
I'm not looking directly at you, Elizabeth, and I'm wondering if you're hearing what I'm saying. I'm seeing the two little dogs running over towards those rocks at the end of the beach. Now I'm looking again at you, Elizabeth. Did you hear what I was saying?
No, not when you were over there. I do now because you're
right
close to me.
Because I'm looking directly at you.
And of course, the waves were just as if someone had turned the volume down. I can still hear them, but softly.
But you didn't hear
voice,
me. You
yeah,
didn't
that's
hear
where
what
I was
saying.
Having the difficulty with the voice, because even in the orchestra, I could just about manage with the music, but then if the conductor said, oh, let's go from letter A or whatever, I wouldn't have had a clue what he had said.
Yeah, you've got.
It wasn't so much of the music that I had difficulty, you know, that's why I'm not so sad about it. Well, if it's just the human voice. But obviously, there are times when you want to connect, and it's terribly frustrating. Because before I got these, you'd be in a group of people and they'd all be laughing about some joke, and then someone would have to explain it to you again, and by then it wasn't funny anymore. You know, it was hard for, it is hard for people to think that you're not stupid, or, you know, they do, if you don't pick up things as fast as everyone else, they think you're just a bit stupid.
So we walk back up to the
yes.
house.
Strategies. Oh, okay, thanks. I didn't bring my key, and I couldn't hear if the bell had actually worked. Thanks, Richard. No.
Come here.
Let me just get her in.
I suppose, like everything else, when things happen gradually, you don't immediately react, or you get used to that particular sort of predicament. So, and I was in a position in the orchestra where we kind of could see each other. I was in the first violin, she'd be, so all I needed to do is actually even just turn my head slightly and I would see her. And sometimes I'd see this worried look in her face, and sometimes I'd actually have to kind of repeat what was said, which is obviously that would have happened after quite a while from the time she knew that she had a problem.
Probably the most famous deaf musician today is Evelyn Glennie, the first and only full-time professional classical percussion soloist.
I wanted to talk to her. She came and played with us a couple of years ago. I suppose before I had kind of come out about my own problems. And I wanted to chat to her because she's just a fascinating person, and I went down to her dressing room in the concert hall, but she wasn't there. I had plucked up my courage, you know, to talk to her. Of course, I was near tears. The whole thing was so emotional for me, but she wasn't there and I never got a chance. But maybe her journey was quite a bit different, I'm not sure, but she's, I don't know how she manages. She's wonderful and such a musical percussionist. You hear her playing the vibraphone or something, she just have you holding your breath because you can't believe it's so beautiful.
Do you know anything about Beethoven's deafness?
Well, no, I mean, I don't think anybody does, to be honest. What we know is from what he wrote, and the surmise is that he had this otosclerosis. And I think there's a story about him putting his head on the piano to pick up the sound, because maybe he didn't get the conducting sound that he had good, well, not good inner ear, you know, but he was able to pick that up better if he had direct transmission through the bones of the skull rather than through the middle ear. So things like that, I suppose, have made people piece together this idea that he had what we call otosclerosis today.
Is that what you've got?
Yeah, yeah, the spongy growths on the bones of the middle ear. I was invited to exhibit my ceramics, much to my surprise and delight, at the end of school last year. There was a visitor to the exhibition that we had there, and he liked what I was making. He seemed to be, he owned a gallery or works for a gallery with a partner, so he invited me to exhibit, and I was flattered that he liked what I was making, so I foolishly said yes, But I've been working particularly hard now since, well, I suppose for the last week or so, because a very kind person helped me to make this two-piece mould. So I'm casting these lovely song thrushes for my exhibition because I have a bit of a bird theme happening at that.
Are you happy with the way that fella turned out?
I am. I'm so happy with this mould. I can't believe. I've just fettled down the seam a little bit and I'll trim this so that he'll actually stand on his own.
Even in making ceramics, Elizabeth can't help making flute sounds.
Actually, I have some of these birds up on the top of the dresser. I was looking for a bird that would make a sound.
Yeah.
But it was actually quite difficult to make the recorder mouthpiece, you know, the windway and the fipple and getting everything right and trying to get a sound out of them. I nearly was ringing up John O'Gods to book a bed. Because I'd be blowing into them to test them and no noise would be coming out.
Is that one you made yourself?
No, but that was kind of my model. And we were in Romania recently and I bought this one, which is more sophisticated. You know, he makes, I think if I practiced him, I'd probably be able to play quite a nice tune out of him.
It's amazing.
It's so nice.
It's a lovely little thing.
What trouble I had, because I still don't actually understand. There's one that doesn't speak so well, and you have to blow less hard. Yeah, he's a bit feeble. Maybe he could go into the outcast basket.
Quick change.
Let's do the last bit.
Last number? Okay.
Not only is Elizabeth preparing for her ceramics exhibition, she's also going to do a solo concert in the National Gallery with a surprise guest violinist, Mircea.
This is, I think, my favourite room in Dublin. It's the Shaw Room in the National Gallery. I'd say it's the biggest room in the whole gallery. It's absolutely splendid. Wonderful pillars and decorated ceilings, chandeliers, wooden floors. And it's got a wonderful double staircase at the end of the room. It's just one of my favourite places and it's wonderful for music. I really think it's one of the best venues we have for music in the city. It's all a process, you know. By the time the day comes, you're ready. I'm ready to go. I'm just dying to play. I know I'm going to love every minute. I just hope that whoever comes along, and I hope maybe more than one person does, that they will enjoy it as much as I'm going to. Because I play so little now, whenever I play, it's just such a thrill when I have someone to play for or someone to listen to me. It's just part of what music is about for me, like sending the message and getting it back. And
is that something you miss a lot since you stopped
working? Yes, well, exactly. You see, so my chances to play are really few and far between. But I was just saying to Mircea before I came out, when I was in the orchestra, I might have done maybe, I don't know, 5-6 concerts a week. And now I do less than that a year. But the preparation is the same, and the fretting and the worrying and the practicing, it's the same, because you have the same amount of preparation for one as you have for 10. So I really put my heart and soul into the run up to something like this, and it's because I choose to do it, it's got to be something I enjoy. I want to not use any help, you know, until after the concert finishes, so I can judge the sound that I make better, if you follow any of that. I always have to take my hearing aids out when I play anyway, because they jangle, they give me a semitone echo and they just drive me nuts. And I'm used to hearing the sound that I make through my jaw anyway, straight into my inner ear, so that's a tiny little innocent instrument, and it sounds like a whole orchestra to me in here. I don't need them for when I play. It's more for voices now. I'm at a disadvantage with voices. But because I wanted to be tuned in to my own sound, you see, I decided, okay, I'm not going to use them today. But it means as if I'm not even plugged in, you know, for voices. But I think it'll be worth it when I start to play. It's not going to be a huge difference, you know.
I noticed when you were rehearsing there with Mircea that you had to turn towards him to hear what you were, not the music, but what the speech.
Oh, yeah, sure, I haven't a clue. I mean, Mircea's voice is very low, and I have severe difficulty, I think, with the low frequencies. It's just a rumble. I don't hear any articulation in it. But for music, you know, I have no problems.
You have no difficulty hearing the high frequencies of
Yeah,
violin.
I have no trouble. No trouble with the music. It's funny that. Bad things can happen to you, but it doesn't mean you're unlucky. I think you can learn from them and maybe go to a different place that you mightn't have gone to had that not happened to you. And, you know, that's the way I would see misfortune, if you like. Hopes and fears. I suppose I could confidently say I don't give fears too much time, but hopes that I'd continue playing the flute and loving every minute of it, and that I would get good at drawing and painting and throwing on the wheel and maybe, you know, combine all those mediums and go forward like that, that I'd almost get a new identity, not a new identity, but a more fleshed out identity, because I'm actually at the moment doing what I love. And I just want to continue.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.